Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Hillary Clinton is expected Sunday to formally announce her intention to run for president in the 2016 election. The former Secretary of State will announce her campaign for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination with an online video posted on social media, according to sources that are familiar with her plans, speaking to media outlets. They say she will make stops in key early voting states that include Iowa and New Hampshire. It will be Clinton's second presidential bid after a failed effort in 2008 when Barack Obama won the party's nomination on his way to becoming president. Clinton is considered a huge favorite to win the Democrats' nomination this time. If elected, the former First Lady would be the nation's first female president. Turkey quickly protested the Vatican Sunday after Pope Francis marked the 100th anniversary of the mass killing of Armenians by calling it a genocide. Ankara told the Roman Catholic Church's ambassador to Turkey that it was deeply sorry and disappointed about the pontiff's description about the 1915 massacre and said it was a problem of trust with the Vatican. The Turkish foreign minister tweeted that the Pope's statement, which is far from historic and legal truths, is unacceptable. The pontiff said during a mass at St. Peter's Basilica that the killing of what Armenia says are as many as 1.5 Armenians by Ottoman Turks was the first genocide of the 20th century. Meanwhile, Orthodox Christians around the world are celebrating Easter Sunday. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko attended Easter services at St. Sophia's Cathedral in Kiev. Easter marks a day Christians believe Jesus was resurrected after his crucifixion more than 2,000 years ago. This is VOA News. Cuban President Raul Castro was not the only Latin American leader to meet with U.S. President Barack Obama at the America Summit in Panama. Mr. Obama met with the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who wants the U.S. to lift sanctions recently slapped on 7 senior Venezuelan officials accused of human rights abuses tied to anti-government protests last year in Venezuela. A bomb explosion in a shopping mall parking lot in southern Thailand has triggered fears of more violence targeting the country's highly lucrative tourism industry. Ron Corbin reports.
The bomb blast in the basement car park of a department store on the island of Samui came late Friday night and injured 7 people, including an Italian girl. Investigators said the improvised bomb was detonated remotely and completely destroyed the vehicle, which was reported to be stolen from the southern province of Yala. The attack on the resort island follows the explosion of 2 small devices outside a major shopping mall in the Thai capital in early February that injured 2 people. A security advisor to the government, Panatan Wataniagorn, says the investigations are also looking into whether the attack was linked to Thailand's bloody Muslim-led insurgency in the 3 southern provinces bordering Malaysia. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
South Korean and Libyan officials say unidentified gunmen attacked a South Korean embassy in Tripoli Sunday, killing 2 local security guards. Officials say the gunmen fired from a passing car at the embassy compound, killing the 2 guards and wounding another. A foreign ministry spokesman in Seoul said the 3 South Koreans, including 2 diplomats working at the embassy, were not harmed. A ministry official said Seoul is considering evacuating its diplomats from Libya. At the Masters Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, American Jordan Spieth has a 4-stroke lead over Britain's Justin Rose heading into the final round today. 2-time Masters champions Phil Mickelson of the United States is in 3rd place. 4-time champion Tiger Woods is on his 5-way tie for 5th place. Woods was asked Saturday how he assesses his performance so far.
I think what I've done all week has been pretty good. Coming from where I came from and having to change my entire release pattern, that was tough, and people have no idea how hard it was to do that. And to come back here and play major championship and, you know, to be in the mix, granted, I got to shoot a super low one tomorrow, but at least I've given myself a chance going into tomorrow.
April 12th is International Day of Human Spaceflight, marking the day in 1961 when a 27-year-old cosmonaut became the world's first man in space. His historic single orbit around the Earth lasted only 108 minutes, ushered in a new chapter of history, space travel. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
That Al-Shabaab has used money transfer companies to move funds. That's well established.
Some experts call on Kenya to rescind a decision banning Somali money transfer companies in the country.
Bashir has been campaigning the president, traveling around, but that's over now. And even then, only where they held rallies and all, there was some excitement in the air.
Sudanese head to the polls on Monday, the 1st, after South Sudan became an independent country. We'll have details.
La Croix Rouge de la République démocratique.
He says the Red Cross in the DRC, which he represents, has never been associated in any way with this business.
And the Red Cross denies a report that it handed over bodies buried in a mass grave near Kinshasa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The All Progressives Party, or APC, has significantly made gains in Saturday's gubernatorial elections, prompting fears that Nigeria might be heading to a dominant one-party state. This after the chairman of the APC warned members of the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, defecting to the APC to remain in their party and form a formidable opposition to deepen the country's bourgeois democracy. For analysis, Dr. Ioana Mivanyi, a lecturer at Kaduna Polytechnics, joins us live via telephone link-up. Good evening, Dr. Mivanyi.
Good evening.
Well, let me ask you, why was there a reported low voter turnout during the election Saturday?
From my interviews around and my own opinion, I think some people were disenfranchised due to the late arrival of election materials on 28th. And some people felt maybe it's not their candidate this time around. And I think the importance and the magnitude of election of 28 is not as that of, the one of 11 is not as that of 28 for some others.
Well, were you pleased with the way the elections were conducted so far, especially yesterday's?
Well, generally what I have to think about is that initially when the card reader was introduced, I felt it's something that is new and it should have been tested and retested on many people and many constituencies and over a period of time, because me as a researcher, I felt something, a national election that is important like that should not be a testing ground for introducing something new. But somehow, according to reports, that there has been an improvement upon the 28th election.
Now, there are concerns, as you have heard, that Nigeria is tilting towards a one-party state after the defeat of the PDP in the presidential election and the significant gains made by the APC in the gubernatorial election. What's your take about that?
Well, I feel that is a bit impulsive at this time because it has happened of old when PDP gained many of the states and had the apex of the government. So from Nigerian history and looking at the acculturation of the society from different factors, I don't think for now that people should start thinking of one-party system for Nigeria just because a few people have defected to the intended or the elected party, that is APC. As a researcher also, I think that we should have objective grounds before we can have our assumption or hypothesis to think at this time that Nigeria is likely to have a one-party system. From my own point of view as a psychologist, we still have a long period to sort out some factors before we can now think from our acculturated background that Nigeria can have a single-party system.
I understand where you're coming from, Dr. Mivanyi, but then the national chairman of the APC, John Odige Oyegu, advised those defecting to the party to stay in their party in order to ensure the APC has a vibrant opposition to us as a check on the party. But why do you think there's this massive defection? Because a prominent member of the APC once told me that some people are of the view that there is no, quoting him, oxygen outside government. Is this the reason why there's appear to be this defection?
I laugh because, well, if I was in the position, I would have thought so, that defection at this time is not really genuine, because I feel somebody who is focused, who has objectives for life, even as a partisan politician, should be able to say, look, I have failed. What have I done that has made me fail? What are those things I'm supposed to look into in order to make a better future? Because it's not really that these people who are defecting have the heart of really staying with APC because that is their objective or that is their love. The love for each one of Nigerians should be, how do we build Nigeria to be a better nation than it was yesterday? So if somebody who is defecting from PDP is thinking of a change that is contextual and that is also enduring, then people should not look at the immediate reinforcement or the immediate situation as a reason to defect.
Well, apparently, so I think, apparently the defection has been a concern to President-elect General Muhammadu Buhari, who weighed in and said that it is unlikely that those who are defecting en masse to the APC will serve in any ministerial positions in his incoming administration. Is that a proper position to take as a president-elect?
Well, I didn't see him talk on television, but I've read it on the net and I've chewed what he has said. I think it is right. I mean, nurturing a society is not done in a day. And so if I had been there suffering like he has been there since 2003. This is the fourth time he has now tried and eventually won. I feel there are people who have been with him. I know somebody particularly, a cousin of mine, who has been there not because of the party, but because he believes in the objective of Buhari. I have had time to talk with this man. I said, what is your own? You have gone in three times. You have not won, and you are still holding on to this party. He said, no, I am not for this party. I am for the objective of this man. I believe in what he's doing. So it depends on the objectives of the vectors. Are they really coming in to serve and help in building the party and building Nigeria, or they are coming in because they're expecting appointments? If that's the reason why they are going in, I will be in the same shoe to say, yes, there have been people there who have worked for this, who have labored, who have gone through thick and thin, And so you coming in today will have no ground to start thinking that you will have a status on appointment.
Are Nigerians feeling the wind of change that the APC has been promising? Briefly.
Well, change, if I will look at it psychologically, is mainly with the human beings, because human beings need to change before anything will change. That's why in education we say learning has taken place. Only there is when there is a difference between the way a learner is looking at a particular situation, a particular need, that will now show the person helping him to understand things that this person has changed. So we are keeping our fingers crossed to see whether this change is a change of substance or a change, a holistic change of the human being and the society. So we cannot say much about that type of change, but we are looking and waiting to see how the change will be. But as a Nigerian, I know that the change that is really going to be changed is when human beings have changed about so many things that are happening.
Thank you.
In the environmental, change in the cognition, change in the social structure. Like what we are practicing now is a conglomeration of many things. But we will not also give up hope that the...
Thank you very much. That was Dr. Ioana Mivanyi, a lecturer at Kaduna Polytechnics. She joined us from Kaduna in northern Nigeria. Pressure is mounting on Kenya to let Somali money transfer companies resume their services. Kenya revoked the licenses of 13 money transfer companies this week after accusing them of having links with the Al-Shabaab militants, a group that claimed responsibility for the attacks in Garissa University, which killed 148 students. Mark Bryden, the director of Sahan Research, told VOA Somali Service reporter Harun Maruf that the likelihood that all those money transfer companies are linked to terrorism in a structural way is unlikely.
Well, obviously, if the Kenyan government has got firm intelligence or evidence that money transfer companies are involved in financing terrorism, then they have every right. But I think the likelihood that all of these companies are linked in some structured way to terrorism is highly unlikely. Many of these companies are not, in fact, what people call hawalas, which are informal money transfer companies. They are, in fact, licensed, registered money transfer organizations. They operate, if they operate in Europe and the United States, the same laws that apply to banking apply to them. They have to comply with anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing regulations. And it's a highly regulated industry. Their headquarters, many of them have in Dubai. That's another very regulated financial environment. And so it actually would be surprising if these companies were across the board involved in terrorism.
So why do you think the Kenya government took this decision?
Well, there has been a lot of talk in the media about some of these companies being involved in terrorism. There's no doubt that Al-Shabaab has used money transfer companies to move funds. That's well established. You know, just as many transnational criminal organizations use bank accounts to move funds. But that doesn't make these companies complicit in terrorism. And I think one of the important considerations for the Kenyan government and for others is that if money cannot move through these companies, these are companies that keep records, that make investigation possible, then the money is going to move into informal channels underground and it'll be even harder to track terrorist financing. So this is potentially a counterproductive move.
And on the other hand, how should this situation be approached? What should Kenya do in order to correct this decision?
Well, in the notice that the Kenyan government published listing these organizations and also individuals that it accuses of links to terrorism, It gave a window of 24 hours for them to reply and to give cause for why they should not be lifted. I expect most didn't even see the Gazette until the 24-hour window had passed. And so I think one option would be for the Kenyan government to extend that window to give these companies the opportunity to open their books, to demonstrate to the Kenyan government that they are not financing terrorism, allow them to be inspected by Kenya's Financial Investigations Unit, and basically to come clean. And I think probably that would go far to address the concerns of the Kenyan government that you know, whether these companies are in fact supporting terrorism. But it would require the deadline to be extended and probably a more intensive review of their accounts rather than this what appears to be a very hasty designation across the board.
And also published along that money transfer services list were a number of individuals who were said to be suspects, people who may have association with Al-Shabaab, some of them known Al-Shabaab members, others not so known. Tell me about what's wrong with this list and what's right with the list.
Well, the first problem with the list, many governments publish lists like this. The United States Treasury, Office of Foreign Assets Control, for example, has a very extensive list. The European Union has a sanctions list. The UN has sanctions list. And the first characteristic of this list is that it's lacking clear identifiers. There are some names on this list that could refer to dozens, if not hundreds, of individuals who have the same name. And a list like this really requires very specific identifiers in addition to the names. Multiple spellings of the name, date of birth, place of birth, passport numbers if possible, to make sure that the bank accounts or the assets of innocent people are not blocked or frozen together with people who are believed to be associated with terrorism.
Matt Bryden is the director of Sahan Research. He spoke with VOA Somali Service reporter Harun Maruf from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Sudanese head to the polls in the first election since the South seceded from the North in 2011. The elections to be held between 13 and 15 April are marred by controversy as most traditional political parties opted to boycott the polls. The parties had demanded a postponement until the constitution is amended. Nabil Mohamed Biaju is a freelance journalist in Khartoum. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him there by phone to find out the mood a day before the elections.
Well, no, there's no excitement at all. I mean, they've been campaigning, Bashir's been campaigning, the president, traveling around, but that's over now. And even then, only where they held rallies and all, there was some excitement in the air, but the majority, the overwhelming majority of the people are different to the whole thing altogether.
The president has been in power since 1989. Do people expect a change, or do they see this as a no-change election?
No. The campaign slogan talk about change, positive change, and national dialogue, and, you know, how Sudan needs a strong man like Bashir to lead it out of, you know, the many problems the country is in right now. But, you know, you can see that people are not buying it. Most of them know that it's just window dressing, because the government is looking for legitimacy. It's a way to confirm or reconfirm Mr. Bashir as a democratically elected president and all of that. People don't expect anything to come out of it. And like I said, the majority of the political parties are boycotting the election altogether.
Why are they boycotting the election?
Because they don't believe it's going to be a legitimate democratic party. One. Two, they have been making demands about the war in for Southern Kurdistan, and they've been demanding that the government allow freedom of speech, assembly, political freedom. All their argument is that the environment is not conducive for elections right now.
But we understand there are 15 candidates. Six of them belong to parties, others are independent. Who are these people?
Well, yes. Yeah. Well, there's six, yeah. They belong to different small parties, like the main party, Umma Party. They're boycotting the elections. The Political Alliance, Opposition Alliance, they're also boycotting the Communist Party. Of course, boycotting the election. Even the Reform Now party that's now led by Ghazi Salahuddin, who used to be the Secretary of State and in his cabinet, they're also boycotting the election. The six candidates who were nominated by political parties are not that known. And the overwhelming majority of the candidates are running as independent candidates, independent of any political party.
Nabil Mohamed Biagio is a freelance journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Meanwhile, the Red Cross in the Democratic Republic of Congo is denying an official's report that it handed over some of the bodies buried in a mass grave near Kinshasa last month. The organization told VOA it was not involved with the burial in any way. For VOA, Nick Long has this report from Goma in the Eastern DRC.
The discovery of a mass grave near Kinshasa, said by the government to contain hundreds of bodies, has prompted rumours that some anti-government demonstrators killed during protests in January might have been buried there. The government has denied these rumours. On Tuesday, the interim governor of Kinshasa, Robert Luzalamu Mavema, told reporters that the 421 bodies buried at the site on March the 19th include 300 corpses of stillborn children and fetuses, 57 of abandoned and destitute persons, and 64 of unidentified people. He added that some of these bodies were handed over by the Red Cross. The president of the Red Cross in the DRC, Dominic Lutula, says the organization played no role in regard to the bodies or the grave.
La Croix Rouge de la République démocratique du Congo, je représente aujourd'hui.
He says the Red Cross in the DRC, which he represents, has never been associated in any way with this business. We were never involved, he says.
J'ai vérifié au niveau de nos volontaires de la ville de Kinshasa, du comité.
Lutula adds that he has checked with Red Cross volunteers in Kinshasa, with the provincial committee in Kinshasa, with hospitals and morgues in the city, and with Red Cross members at Maluku, near the burial site, and he is sure no one in the Red Cross was informed of this or associated with it in any way. Lutula also told VOA Friday he was going to a meeting at the US embassy. Human rights activists have been calling for the corpses at Maluku to be exhumed to check if any are of anti-government protesters killed in January. According to Human Rights Watch, at least 42 people died in protests in Kinshasa between January the 19th and 22nd, while others involved in the demonstrations have disappeared. Other rights organisations assert that hundreds of people disappeared after the protests. On Wednesday, the Belgian government called for a credible independent investigation and for the burial site to be protected to prevent any loss of evidence as to the identification of the bodies. The government has said a judicial inquiry is being launched into the circumstances surrounding the mass grave. Last Friday, Interior Minister Evariste Bossab said the bodies could be exhumed if that was judged necessary, but on Monday, government spokesman Lambert Mende said there would be no exhumation. On Thursday, Mende told the news media the 421 bodies had been brought to the central morgue in Kinshasa by various medical organisations in the capital and that the burial had been carried out by the municipal authorities. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, combating terrorism across the continent. From the Al-Shabaab militant massacre of nearly 100 university students in Kenya to the kidnapping of 600 schoolgirls by Boko Haram. Is Africa's war on terrorism winnable? That's next time, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. That, of course, will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sport for Sunday, April 12th. Let's kick off with African football. The first set of qualifiers have emerged for the football event of the 2015 All-Africa Games to be held in the Congolese capital, Brazzaville. They are Burkina Faso and Ivory Coast. In the return leg final round of qualifiers played on Saturday, Burkina Faso held Ivory Coast to a goalless draw in Abidjan, but qualified 2-1 on aggregate, having won the first leg by the same scoreline. For its part, Sudan won the ticket to the games, despite losing 1-0 to South Africa in the return leg at the Dobsonville Stadium in Soweto. Sudan, which won the first leg 2-0 at home, advanced 2-1 on aggregate. Burkina Faso and Sudan now join Congo in the 2015 All-Africa Games. Congo qualified automatically as hosts. Five more teams will pick the tickets to the games after the return leg matches scheduled for today, Sunday. Overall, eight teams will play in the football event of the All-Africa Games, tagged the African Olympics. The football event is for under-23 players. Staying with African football, Algeria and Ghana are not happy for losing the hosting rights for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations to Gabon. Last week, African football governing body, CAF, named Gabon as host of the 31st edition of the tournament ahead of the two countries. Algeria says it was shocked by the decision. CAF's decision shocked us, and we can't accept it till now. Algeria's Sports Minister Mohamed Tami said, "Our bid was the best among all, but the CAF president gave it to Gabon. With all respect to Gabon, that was illogical," he says. The minister said Algeria would change its way of dealing with the CAF and vowed to challenge the decision. For its part, Ghana says the award of the 2017 tournament to Gabon was not transparent. A member of Ghana's bid committee for the tournament, Randy Abbey, alleged that the majority of the CAF's 14-strong executive committee were kept in the dark throughout. He says even the executive committee members who cast their ballots did not know the result of the vote. Abbey claims that only two of them, with CAF President Issa Hayatou, were called to look at the vote. Gabon co-hosted the 2012 edition of the two-yearly tournament with neighbor Equatorial Guinea. The 2017 tournament was originally scheduled to be hosted by Libya, but CAF decided to take the hosting rights away from Libya in August 2014 because of the crisis in the North African country. Turning to athletics, African runners won the men's and women's events at the Paris Marathon today, Sunday. Kenyan's Mark Kori won the 39th edition of the marathon in a personal best of 2 hours, 5 minutes, and 49 seconds. Courier took more than a minute off his previous best of 2 hours, 7 minutes and 8 seconds, set when he finished second in the 2013 Seoul Marathon. Although he has had some success over shorter distances, this was without doubt the biggest win of his career. In the women's race, Ethiopia's Meseret Mengistu made a massive breakthrough to win in 2 hours, 23 minutes and 24 seconds, taking almost 6 minutes off her personal best. And at the Vienna City Marathon, also today, Sunday, Africans also dominated. Ethiopia's Cisse Lema won the men's event in 2 hours, 7 minutes and 31 seconds. Kenya's Duncan Kwech was second with 2 hours, 12 minutes and 14 seconds, while Siraj Jena of Ethiopia finished third in 2 hours, 12 minutes and 48 seconds. Ethiopia's pre-race favorite and defending champion Jetu Feleke dropped out with a muscle injury after 17 kilometers. Finally, a belated honor has come for South African football legend Steve Mokone, but it was posthumous. Mokone, the first black South African to play in Europe's top leagues and a trailblazer in the 1950s, died last month in Washington, D.C. at the age of 82. He was honored as such on Saturday at South Africa's largest stadium by some of the country's top political leaders, a sharp contrast to his playing days when his success was ignored by the racist regime in apartheid-era South Africa. This was a hidden hero, an unknown hero in his home country. South African Football Association President Danny Jordan said at a memorial service for Mokone at the FNB Stadium in Johannesburg. Mokone, a nimble, skillful forward, dazzled in Britain, the Netherlands, Spain, France, Italy, Australia, and Canada, all at a time when he wasn't even allowed to play for his own country's all-white team. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Wasama penzi safari, ujana ni manji ya moto, walile naga zamani. Pili tumetoka mbali, omara tizo changa moto, tuvisa visa furani. Tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi Matu sonone kapo kwangu simanzi Ay, Tatu kidonda chako kwangu maradhi Oyani sonone kapo kwangu simanzi Kwa mahaba ulonipa nimenongewa Vurugu patashika Ay, Punguza kidogo Na mengine kadhalika Toto suna nielewa Apo apo lipo shika Ukiongeza kidogo Ni mwenza kota unia My sweetie, sweetie number one. My baby, you are number one. My darling, roho yangu mama My sweetie, sweetie number one. My baby, you are number one. Oh, roho yangu mama Na uivu sikatai Mana uchungwa mapenzi na ujua So sije kunilagai Kaja kuzama ukani zingua Na uivu sikatai Mana uchungwa mapenzi na ujua So sije kunilagai Mwenzio na ugopa Now show me how they do Bololo, bololo, aye Bololo, bololo, se Bololo, bololo, aye And show me how you do Bololo, bololo, aye Bololo, bololo, se My sweetie, sweetie, number one. My baby, oh, woman, number one. Oh, oh, young mama.
Kwa nyumbani If you MC Unachemba kitu gani
Paniki, brother.
Ah, wapi, nani kapaniki. Acha uoga dogo.
No.
Nasema siku hizi waga kuna fungate, mapenzi hayana samani. Hivyo mwambie wanaopenda bachache, wengi wanatamani. Wanazaga kwa tafadhali, wakishapewa wanapotea. Nenda mwambie aje azari, na dua njema na muombea. So asidanganywe na gari, burudani na fedha, mimi akanichukia. Akalishusha thamani penzi nalompenda, kisa mvinyo na bia. Asidanganywe na gari, burudani na fedha, mimi akanichukia. Mwambie asisikie mapenzi.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Africa mourns with the people of Kenya who have suffered grievous loss when Al-Shabaab attackers killed 148 students at a northeastern university. Some have suggested that the numbers might increase. The most gruesome part of this attack was the decision of Al-Shabaab to separate Christian and Muslim students, killing the Christians while letting the Muslims go free. Although the government has been criticized for not providing adequate security at the campus, it has since taken security measures to protect the university and its environment. It has also taken measures to close banks transmitting remittances that may cause problems for innocent Kenyans that have no relationship with Al-Shabaab. It may be necessary for the government to consider more transparent measures so that innocent Kenyans are not suffered and they may receive their remittances. The incident itself reminds all of us that the problem of Somalia remains unresolved. In this era of what I've called media diplomacy, it has become the practice for people to claim victory in resolving disputes. The United Nations, UNISOM, the government in Mogadishu, and others have prematurely said that they have defeated Al-Shabaab. Certainly, they have pushed Al-Shabaab fighters out of Mogadishu. They have pushed them out of the seaport in the south, Kismayo, where they used to bring in weapons and conduct trade. But those who know Somalia very well will testify that Al-Shabaab still controls most of the countryside in Somalia. This is why it is necessary to proceed from where we are now in Somalia. We should also be mindful that even though we now have a national government in Mogadishu, that government was never elected by the people of Somalia. It is the product of a selection method based on clan politics. Then the time is opportune to begin to put in place measures so that the people of Somalia will be able to elect their own government. They are seeing what is happening right now. Though Al-Shabaab is not in Mogadishu, it has been able to stage dramatic attacks in the city, even the presidential palace and at the airports. It has also perhaps used Somalia as a base to conduct attacks in Kenya, like the mall in Nairobi and now at the university. The United Nations, the African Union, should be able to suggest to the parties in Somalia to proceed to see whether some kind of reconciliation should be conducted. When you look at Afghanistan, the Taliban has committed similar atrocities, yet the government and other parties involved are trying to negotiate with the Taliban. It is very important that people consider whether they could find ways to talk to Al-Shabaab, even though it is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Without doing so, we are going to be confronted with more atrocities, not only in Somalia, but in the neighboring countries. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impoga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Adeyemi, and our engineer for today, Xiaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, he who has not reached his destination never gets tired. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States was among the first to recognize the Central Asian countries of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan after they gained their independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. From the beginning, the United States has sought to assist Central Asia's development, promoting the ideals of democracy and free markets, said U.S. Principal Deputy Secretary of State for South and Central Asian Affairs Richard Hoagland. Central Asia has much to offer the United States and its neighbors. While the region's government still struggled to find a balance between secular state policies and religious freedom, its Muslim majority and religious minority groups have lived together peacefully for centuries. The region is also rich in natural resources, including natural gas and oil reserves, uranium, and hydropower potential. The United States clearly has an enduring interest in strong bilateral relationships with each of the five Central Asian states. Broadly speaking, the U.S. has four critical areas of cooperation and concentration in Central Asia: security cooperation, economic ties, promotion of human rights and good governance, and efforts to bolster each country's sovereignty and independence. Partly as a result of the region's history and conflicting national interests, Central Asia is now one of the least economically integrated regions in the world. But with the right engagement from its partners and neighbors, it can transform itself into a model of connectivity, said Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Hoagland. Already, intra-regional trade is increasing and the cost of moving goods across borders is decreasing. The U.S. is doing its part to help build Central Asian markets and integrate the region with global markets, specifically through the new Silk Road Initiative, which seeks to connect Central and South Asia by improving North-South energy markets, trade and transport infrastructure, customs and border procedures, and business and people-to-people networks. Over the years, the U.S. has strongly supported assistance programming to improve governance and human rights in Central Asia. The U.S. has supported human rights organizations, rule of law reforms, civil society, and the mass media, including social media. The United States will continue to invest its resources in the region's security and its economic, political, and social development. We have been with the countries of Central Asia from the beginning, said Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Hoagland, and we will still be with them in the years and decades to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.